This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, a young Palestinian father dies after Israeli interrogation in a prison equipped by private British-Danish security firm G4S. New documents show the U.S. investigated Gaza flotilla passengers for terror ties, but not Israel's slaying of a U.S. teen by Israeli forces. Also, a new protest tent is challenging evictions of Palestinians in East Jerusalem. An Israeli highway hits a Palestinian village like a tsunami. A Palestinian-American teacher is deported by Israel. We'll hear an interview with Noor Judah about her ordeal.
They don't consider anyone of Arab descent, whether it's Palestinian or otherwise, an American citizen or a British citizen or a German citizen. They consider no one's citizenship valuable if you have an Arab name. End of story.
And news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, including new campaigns by U.S. university students urging pension fund giant TIAA Cref to divest from Israeli occupation profiteers, and more. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor for the Electronic Intifada in Berkeley. We begin with the death of 30-year-old Arafat Jaradat. The Electronic Intifada reported on Sunday that Arafat Jaradat died on Saturday, February 23rd, after being interrogated by Israel's Internal Security Service, Shin Bet, also known as the Shabak. After his arrest at midnight on February 18th, during which he was beaten, Jaradat was held at Al-Jalameh Detention and Interrogation Center before being transferred to Megiddo Prison. Jaradat was arrested under the suspicion that he was involved in stone throwing that had wounded an Israeli settler in the occupied West Bank, reported the Bethlehem-based Ma'an news agency, citing a Shin Bet statement. The Palestinian minister in charge of prisoners' affairs called for an internal investigation into his death that may have resulted from torture, Ma'an reported. The Israel Prison Service claimed that Jaradat had prior health conditions and that he had died of a heart attack. However, Jaradat's family stated that he was in good health before his arrest and did not have any prior conditions. The Palestinian rights group Al-Haq tweeted the findings of the autopsy report on the case of Arafat Jaradat's death, which contradicts Israel's claim that Jaradat died of a heart attack. Al-Haq said that the autopsy showed that Jaradat had died of shock. His body had two broken ribs, blood inside his nose, and bruises in his mouth, and quote, clear signs of torture, beatings on the chest, lashes on his back and shoulders near his spine. They added, quote, the body displayed multiple signs of beating. On Friday, March 1st, Al-Haq posted a report by 14 Palestinian and Israeli organizations who condemn, quote, the overall lack of accountability for torture of Palestinian detainees. The report states that, quote, the Palestinian Human Rights Organizations Council, along with Adala, Public Committee Against Torture in Israel, and Physicians for Human Rights Israel, express their outrage at the death of Arafat Jaradat, which, according to the autopsy report, was caused by torture and ill treatment inflicted while in Israeli custody. Quote, the preliminary autopsy found that Arafat displayed severe bruising on his upper back, deep bruising along the spine, and significant bruising on both sides of the chest. The postmortem also discovered bruising on both arms and inside the mouth, blood around the nose, and three fractured ribs. In addition, the examination discounted the claim by the Israeli authorities that Arafat died of a heart attack. His heart was completely healthy and there was no evidence of damage or weakness of any kind. The report concludes that all injuries were the result of very recent, severe, and direct torture. The undersigned organizations reiterate the demands made by UN representatives for an immediate international investigation into the death of Arafat Jaradat, with a view to holding those responsible for his death accountable. In a statement, UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, Richard Falk, said, quote, the death of a prisoner during interrogation is always a cause for concern. But in this case, when Israel has shown a pattern and practice of prisoner abuse, the need for outside credible investigation is more urgent than ever. The Electronic Intifada added that Jaradat's death has sparked a mass hunger strike among the thousands of Palestinian political prisoners held in Israeli jails. A spokesperson for Israel's prison service told Ma'an News that approximately 4,500 prisoners in Israeli jails refused food from prison authorities. Meanwhile, sustained protests across the West Bank and Gaza Strip have broken out in condemnation of Israel's ongoing violations against Palestinians inside Israeli prisons. Megiddo Prison and Al Jalameh Detention Facility are both equipped by private British-Danish security firm G4S, which has been the target of boycott campaigns by activists around the world. 30-year-old Arafat Jaradat was from the Palestinian village of Sa'ir near Hebron in the occupied West Bank. He was married and has two young children, a 3-year-old and a 2-year-old. His wife is expecting their third child in June. Those were excerpts of a longer report published this week on the Electronic Intifada. For much more on this story, visit our Rights and Accountability blog section at electronicintifada.net. The Electronic Intifada's Maureen Murphy reported this week that, quote, recently released U.S. government documents related to Israel's deadly May 2010 raid on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla shed new light on the extent to which the U.S. disregarded the rights and safety of U.S. citizens participating in the humanitarian mission to the besieged Gaza Strip and the lengths to which it shielded Israel from accountability. 9 passengers, including a U.S. citizen, were killed and many more injured by Israeli commandos who stormed the flagship Mavi Marmara, provoking international outrage and turning world opinion against Israel, possibly irreversibly. 17 U.S. citizens were aboard the flotilla, including a former U.S. Army colonel and former U.S. ambassador. Passengers were arrested and detained in Israel without charge and eventually deported. The 5,000 pages of documents from various government agencies, many of them heavily redacted, were released after the New York City-based Center for Constitutional Rights sued the U.S. government in May 2011 when the U.S. failed to respond to Freedom of Information Act requests submitted by the CCR 1 month after the attack. The Electronic Intifada adds, quote, the documents show that while the U.S. government tracked citizens participating in the flotilla for months before their scheduled departure to Gaza, it made no efforts to ensure the safety of the passengers and parroted the Israeli government line by characterizing the humanitarian flotilla as a provocation. Quote, the government emails and cables also show the shocking lack of concern regarding the slaying of a U.S. teenager aboard the Mavi Marmara, Furkan Dogan, despite the desperate pleas of his father for information about his son's whereabouts and safety. Our report also adds that, quote, the Obama administration made no inquiry into Furkan Dogan's death and deferred to Israel's own investigations into the incident, even though the attack occurred in international waters. And not only did the U.S. fail to investigate Dogan's killing, it also actively undermined independent international investigations into the siege of the flotilla. The U.S. also made no high-level attempt to retrieve property of U.S. citizens seized during the raid, including cameras that would yield key evidence to understanding the truth of what happened on the Mavi Marmara. Israel is believed to still possess property belonging to U.S. citizens aboard the flotilla. Maureen Murphy spoke with Jessica Lee earlier this week via Skype about this story. Lee is part of a team at the Center for Constitutional Rights endeavoring to learn the truth of the U.S.'s role regarding the 2010 raid. Lee said, quote, it's really a travesty that the United States had an opportunity to press for this evidence, and time again, they accepted Israel's justifications for not turning it over. If you look at the documents, Israeli government officials delayed returning property for years now, and there's no high-level discussion of it. There is no U.S. acknowledgement that this wasn't just someone's property with economic value, but that this was evidence. This wasn't raised in any meaningful manner, and it's really a disappointing showing that the U.S. was not interested in getting the truth out about what happened on this flotilla, end quote. That was an excerpt of an interview with Jessica Lee of the Center for Constitutional Rights with the Electronic Intifada this week. To read more about this story, visit our Rights and Accountability blog at electronicintifada.net. The Electronic Intifada reported this week that a new protest tent has been set up in the occupied East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in a direct action against the waves of evictions of Palestinian families from their homes by Israeli settlers, backed by Israeli forces. Our contributor Andrew Beal reported, quote, although the tent is directly in front of a private home and clearly poses no danger to anyone or anything, police in Jerusalem have twice dismantled the tent. Sheikh Jarrah residents say they will continue to erect the tent during demonstrations held every Friday until the campaign of eviction stops. The protest tent in Sheikh Jarrah stands in front of the home of the Shemazneh family, who have been ordered to leave their home by March 1st, although Israel's high court is currently considering a petition to overturn the eviction order. The eviction of the Shemazneh family is the latest in a long line of evictions in Sheikh Jarrah, aimed at removing Palestinians from the area and replacing them with Jewish Israeli settlers. Quote, "This is an Israeli campaign against us, and we will stay here and stand fast," said Mohammed Shemazneh, one of the organizers of the demonstration. Shemazneh lives in the house facing eviction along with his parents, his wife, and their six children. For much more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. In Beit Safafa, just south of Jerusalem, residents are resisting a highway plan that will cause irreparable harm to their village. Our contributor Math Musleh reported on Thursday that the plan to build Highway 50 intends to connect the Gush Etzion settlement block with other settlements in the northern Jerusalem area. Musleh writes, quote, "The project is part of Israel's wider plan for asserting its control over the greater Jerusalem area, as it continues to annex and confiscate land south of the city in violation of international law. Beit Safafa and the nearby village Sharafat were divided in the 1970s by the construction of Gilo Road, built to connect the newly built Gilo settlement to the city. Beit Safafa and Sharafat, historically inseparable, will now be divided into four parts with the construction of Highway 50. This plan has triggered mass protests in a village which has not witnessed large-scale resistance since the First Intifada. The road is being built by the Moriah Jerusalem Development Corporation. For much more on this story, including the environmental and health impacts residents are reporting and how the villagers in Beit Safafa are filing objections to the plan in court, go to Math Musleh's article at electronicintifada.net. The Electronic Intifada reported this week that a young Palestinian-American who has been working as a teacher at the Friends School in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah was detained and eventually deported back to the U.S. when she attempted to return to the West Bank after a short vacation outside of Palestine. Noor Judah, a contributor to the Electronic Intifada, told us that what was meant to be a short visit turned into a two-month stay after Israel denied her entry at Allenby Crossing on January 5th, even though she has a multiple entry work visa approved by Israel's Interior Ministry. Our report adds that Judah attempted to return to the West Bank again via Ben-Gurion Airport near Tel Aviv on Monday, upon the advice of the Israeli embassy after inquiries were made by members of U.S. Congress on her behalf. But Judah was once again denied entry and sent back to Jordan on Tuesday. Noor Judah spoke to the Electronic Intifada's Maureen Murphy earlier this week.
You know, on Monday, you were detained at Ben-Gurion Airport and eventually deported. Can you explain what happened?
About a few days before I flew, my congresswoman's office, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, along with Congressman Keith Ellison's office, received a response from the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., who they had been corresponding with for a couple of weeks, requesting the reason for my initial denial at Allenby on January 5th. And the Israeli embassy in D.C. responded that, according to whoever they spoke to at Kogat, at the border, I supposedly refused to answer certain questions and therefore refused to cooperate with security procedures and was denied for that reason, but that I can and should retry to enter and that the Israeli embassy would help me when I did so. They said I could choose which border I wanted to go to. I chose to fly to Tel Aviv instead of going to Allenby again, because Fuad, the USAID representative who works on visas with the Friends School, has security clearance to meet me at my gate in Tel Aviv, which he doesn't have to that kind of clearance at Allenby. So he met me at my gate and was with me all day as I was, you know, waiting and being questioned.
So you were first denied entry in December?
I was denied entry January 5th. I left on Christmas Day, December 25th, to go and spend some time with friends for Christmas and New Year's. And then I tried to re-enter on January 5th and was denied for the first time.
It seems pretty arbitrary why they denied you entry. Like, you still haven't gotten, like, a really clear answer as to why.
No, we still haven't gotten an answer. They responded yesterday to Amira Haas from Harrods that my reason for my second denial, that the reason for my second denial was the same, that I refused to cooperate with security questions, which is just a complete lie, because I answered every single question that they had the first time, I answered every single question that they had the second time, and in fact, the second time, after knowing what the reason was the first time, I even asked my interrogator specifically, have I answered all your questions? And he said yes. I was like, do you have anything else you want to ask? He says, if I have a follow-up, I'll come and find you. He came and found me later with a follow-up. I answered his follow-ups. The idea that there was a cooperation is just silly. Amira Haas mentioned the question in her article of acquaintances that I had between August and December. And, you know, I told him, I said, you know, I hang out with the other American teachers and my roommates, names of which they already knew. And that wasn't satisfactory. He was, you know, sarcastic and snide and said, but you're so friendly. Surely you know more people than that. And he basically wanted me to give him a list of every young Palestinian that I knew so that he could, you know, create a file of phone numbers to tap. And I wasn't going to give him that. That's just silly.
How long were you questioned both on Monday and previously at Allenby? Were you held for a long time? And how were you treated?
At Allenby, I arrived on the Israeli-controlled side at about 11:30 a.m. and was put back on a bus to Jordan at 6 p.m. and wasn't told that I was being denied entry until that very moment. And then I landed in Tel Aviv around 12:30, my flight, and also was denied entry at about 7:30 and wasn't told until the very last minute that I was being denied.
And did they put you in immigration detention at Ben Gurion?
Yes. So what happens was, after they told me I was denied, we went and got my luggage from baggage claim. They scanned all of my luggage inside out multiple times, took everything out, checked it. They did a body search, and then they processed me in an office, took a picture, did some paperwork that I wasn't allowed to see. And then I was escorted to an armored van. I was placed in the van and I was taken to an immigration detention center where I spent the night.
Why do you think that Israel denied you entry like they have to so many other Palestinian Americans in particular?
I mean, I think in regards to the particular sort of decision making that happened, my personal opinion is that someone made a mistake at Allenby, and they know it, and that the Shabak, the security apparatus, is annoyed that the diplomatic corps and the political corps are questioning their decision or are trying to help me challenge their decision, and they. I think in some ways we're looking for a way to let me in yesterday, but they didn't know how to let me in and save face. They didn't know how to let me in and basically not find a way to say that they hadn't made a mistake at Allenby. And that this is very much a case of cognitive dissonance and institutional infighting.
And they routinely deny entry to Palestinian Americans. So do you have any thoughts about what that's about, why there's that pattern?
I mean, I think it's very clear that they want as few people with Palestinian origin in what they consider Israel and the occupied territories, because they don't even want the people that are there. So why in God's name would they want us returning in any form or fashion, even if it's for a limited period or for a visit? They don't consider anyone of Arab descent, whether it's Palestinian or otherwise, an American citizen or a British citizen or a German citizen, they consider no one's citizenship valuable if you have an Arab name. End of story. Your citizenship is completely irrelevant to them, and they are ambivalent to any sort of law or alliances with other countries. They do what they want arbitrarily, and the U.S. Embassy and State Department know it.
And do you have any further recourse to try to return to your life in Ramallah, or is it too soon to tell?
It's a little bit too soon to tell right now.
So you're still trying to figure out your options?
Yeah, I'm still looking at options right now.
So what kind of reactions have you gotten to the news about your deportation? And have your students been following your case?
Yeah, I mean, reactions from friends, family, and other organizations that have been following the case have been very surprised and shocked. A few individuals from Human Rights Watch have been following from the press and that kind of thing. And everyone has been sort of very surprised and shocked. The U.S. aid representative was very surprised by the way that it's been handled. Mostly because, I mean, the arbitrariness of it is very clear, right? Had I simply not gone on vacation for 10 days, I would still be teaching. There's absolutely nothing that they would have had reason to come and find me in Ramallah and deport me from there. They absolutely wouldn't have done that. It just happens to be that I took a vacation. I put myself in their crosshairs, so to speak. And they completely took advantage of an opportunity to make sure I couldn't get back to the work that they had already pre-approved for me to do. As far as my students, yeah, they've been following everything, every minute, and they are totally devastated. And I've been trying my best to talk them through it and tell them that, you know, these are things that happen and they need to focus on their studies, and that I'll always be in touch with them, and anything that they need I'm still around for, and that I don't regret going to teach them, and I don't regret fighting to get back regardless of what the result is.
Well, I'm really sorry that this happened to you, and I'm also sorry that your students lost their teacher. So is there anything else that you'd like to tell EI's readers about your experience?
I think it's just important for people to know that while this is an unjust and sort of outrageous thing that has happened, that I had all of the proper paperwork, that there was no reason for my denial, that I've been stranded in a foreign country for 2 months for no particular reason, having to deal with, you know, having to live on my own resources, hire a lawyer, and all of these kinds of things. At the end of the day, my situation is extremely more privileged than many others. At the end of the day, I still, worst case scenario, I go home to my parents and my family in the United States. I have the right to these appeals and to hire this lawyer because I'm an American citizen. Other Palestinians don't have this right. And they don't have always the resources that I've had and the support system that I've had. And I think that that's really something that needs to be emphasized, because for as important as it is a fact that they're doing this to American citizens, all the while lobbying the U.S. Congress to let Israeli citizens in to the United States without visas. Right now they're trying to pass the Israeli Visa Waiver Act in Congress. So, you know, that's a very interesting sort of hypocritical contradiction there. While that's an important point to be discussed, I think it's also an important point that this is these arbitrary denials also happen to Palestinian ID holders. They happen to Jerusalem ID holders. And these are not people who have the same sort of resources and diplomatic pressure that can be put on them like an American can. So, I think that's an important part to remember.
That was Noor Judah recently speaking to the Electronic Intifada. To read more about Noor's ordeal, visit our rights and accountability blog at electronicintifada.net. And now we go to news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Reported in our most recent BDS roundup, current university students have launched a creative campaign demanding that pension fund giant TIAA Cref drop its investments from companies that profit from Israel's violations of Palestinian rights. Holding placards explaining their professional goals, dozens of students from universities around the country are being photographed for the Future Votes Now website on Tumblr, a popular social media and photo sharing site. The campaign also calls for students to add their voices to the campaign on Twitter using the hashtag FutureVotesNow. Future Votes Now says on the website, quote, "We are college and university students. We are aspiring doctors, academics, social workers, human rights advocates, and nonprofit administrators. We demand an end to Israel's occupation of Palestine and corporate involvement with the occupation. We know that TIAA Cref, the preferred retirement plan at many of our universities, invests more than $2 billion in corporations that profit from egregious human rights abuses. We are appalled by TIAA Cref's financial complicity in acts of militarized violence, segregation, and population control. Last month, TIAA Cref shareholders submitted a resolution for divestment from Veolia Environment. Veolia provides segregated services for Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank, including buses forbidden to Palestinians. TIAA Cref, we ask you to remember that we are your future." Also reported in our BDS roundup this week, Shuggy Otis cancels his Tel Aviv performance, while activists encourage Alicia Keys and Depeche Mode to do the same. The Queen Mary University of London Students' Union votes to boycott G4S and Veolia. Veolia's bid for street cleaning contracts is withdrawn in Liverpool, and much more. For other current news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, check out our activism and BDS blog on electronicintifada.net. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, pointed opinion and analysis, and action alerts by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. This week, be sure to check out our newest features, such as Rami Al-Megari's special report from Gaza. Did a Gaza family burn to death because of an unpaid bill? Also, farmers markets bypass foreign aid to Palestine, Palestinian students surrounded by guns at Israeli universities, and our blog posts, witnessing farce and cruelty in an Israeli military court. An arms dealer caught telling lies over exports to Israel. A video shows an Israeli mob celebrating the savage beating of a Palestinian man while shouting racist slogans. A Yarmouk activist describes the atrocious state of the war-torn Palestinian refugee camp in Syria. Photos of settlers mocking Palestinian hunger strikers and Israeli soldiers dressing up as Palestinian fighters. Reviving pinkwashing and Zionist fantasies of violence against queers and transgender people. Quote, oops, one less Arab. Even more disturbing Instagram images from the Israeli army, and much more. At electronicintifada.net, you can also post comments and sign up for our daily newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and a special thanks to Flashpoints and KPFA in Berkeley. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.